From mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds, and into the cosmos, we're pumping wattage high and low, streaming worldwide on the internet, and keeping you company tonight. It's Live every Saturday, the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. And we have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we're rated number one Saturday nights here on News Radio 570 WWNC. And they don't call it the talk of the mountains for nothing. Now, what happens if you kill yourself? That is a touchy subject, isn't it? Well, Pamela Ray Heath and John Climo are authors of Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. Just as the title suggests, they have channeled the spirits of suicide victims and gathered their experiences from the beyond in this impressive new book. To get started, I'll introduce them each separately. Pamela Heath, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm amazed by what an intimidating project this must have been for you. And let's just start with the basics. Please tell us where you're from, where you are, and your description of what you do.
Well, I'm originally from Missouri, and I'm currently living in the Bay Area of California. And I do a lot of things. I'm a physician, I'm a parapsychologist, and I do have some intuition. But I do have to correct one thing. John and I did not actually channel the material in this book. This came from a review of about 400 to 500 books, about a fourth of which had channeled material in it. And then in addition to the reviewing what books had about suicide, we also did ask some psychics to do some channeling for us.
Oh, I see. Well, that makes sense. Then you've gathered from a wide variety of sources. No wonder you have such a substantial collection of experiences and so many unique angles on this subject that is so complicated in so many ways. But also we have with us John Climo. I hope I'm saying his last name correctly.
That's correct. Thank you.
All right. Well, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And please tell us about yourself as well.
Well, my day job for the past 32 years has been as a university professor teaching in doctoral programs. But I began this life as a poet and a painter, and I see myself as essentially a very creative person. And my involvement with channeling, having ended up writing the definitive book on the subject, began with, as a creative person, wondering where my own inspiration and intuitions came from. It seemed to be some self-transcending source, and that really led eventually to my research on channeling.
Well, it seems like a good partnership between you and Pamela, and especially on this project. Now, Pamela, we are inundated in the news every day with the phenomenon of suicide bombers. How do you feel about the mentality of those folks?
Well, I'm very concerned, and that's part of why John and I devoted a fair bit of space in the book to suicide murder. And especially when you look at just what happened the other night with that gentleman who went into a school, that's also suicide murder.
Mm-hmm.
And those people tend to have a rough time, shall we say, in the afterlife, in the sense that they have to deal not only with their own psychological baggage, but the harm that they did to everybody who they affected.
Mm. And I see from your book here that the suicide rate among adolescents is especially disturbing. What can you tell us about that, John?
Well, it's true. It's a topsy-turvy going through kind of crucial changes, biological as well as psychological, for anybody going through adolescence. And you know, if it gets tipped more toward the extreme, one can act extremely from that frame of reference, including not thinking it's worth, even at the age of 15 or 16, going on with your life beyond that, that this is it, I've seen it all, it's not worth it, I'm out of here. And therefore, there's a higher percentage of adolescents commit suicide than at any other age, because of the volatileness of it, the maybe the unrealistic aspect, and the idealistic aspect. The life and themselves is not living up to their ideal of either what existence could or should be, or who they should be. So they get terribly down on life, down on yourself, and presto, it doesn't take much to end it.
Well, if suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States among adolescents, is that figure reflected consistently in the rest of the world, John?
I believe it is more so in the United States and probably Western industrialized cultures because of the complexity, the sophistication, the relative estrangement from nature and from cultural roots and traditional family that you would find in other countries besides, let's say, Great Britain and the United States and a couple of others. So I would say, although I didn't look at that data as carefully, that the suicide rate among adolescents is higher in the United States.
Well, now, Pamela, tell us about this process of channeling or mediumship that helps people connect with these spirits.
Well, that's really John's area of expertise, probably better chance than mine. But I do want to add one thing. Mm-hmm. In addition to the problem of what teenagers have to go to with in terms of their angst, right now we're seeing epidemics of the choking game. And this is where kids aren't at least consciously, deliberately trying to commit suicide, but they end up killing themselves when trying to get high, you know, sexually, by asphyxiation or by, you know, hanging themselves or strangulation. And that is getting to be a growing problem. And some of those kids, they don't quite take the danger of it seriously. And several of those kids were channeled for this book.
So they're hanging themselves while having sex, so to speak.
Masturbating, usually.
Oh, wow. Man, that is weird stuff. Okay, well, John, let's go back to you for that other question.
Right.
Tell us about that process, please.
Yeah, I wrote what's considered the main book on the subject of channeling investigations on receiving information from paranormal sources. And channeling is a kind of a larger term that includes the smaller term mediumship. Some of your listeners are more familiar with mediumship, which normally means communication from the afterlife, from discarnate human spirits coming through mediums who mediate that communication from the other side to this side. And so usually the sources of channeled information for mediumship is deceased human spirits. Channeling is a larger, more inclusive category. It can be nature spirits, it can be gods, it can be extraterrestrials, it can be thought forms, a collective unconscious. Some people even claim you can channel God or and so on. So that it's a larger term. But in all cases, you kind of surrender, you loosen your normal ego and conscious awareness enough to let some self-transcending presence or communication or entity or being come to you and either clairaudiently or telepathically or come through you, or you really step aside enough that the temporarily possessing or working through you presence or entity can actually use your vocal cords, your vocabulary, and so on. Or automatic writing is another kind of automatic flow through you, where you sort of get out of the way and you're the vehicle for it, but you're passive. And then there's cases where you're quite conscious, but you kind of hear it inside yourself, the gist of the information coming to you. It does feel from beyond you. It's self-transcending. It's ego alien. It doesn't feel like your own contents of consciousness or your own little voices within yourself, usually. And you just pass it on. You repeat it into a tape recorder, or you write it down. And these are the kinds of mediumship or channeling that have been taking place for hundreds of years in all cultures, in all times, really. There's even an argument to make that some of the early saints and prophets were channeling Christ. Not Christ, but they were channeling from some transcending Judeo-Christian source, and that Christ himself was actually a mediator between his Father or the Lord or whatever you want to call it and himself. Because a number of times in the Bible he speaks of receiving information, communicating, passing on the communications he's getting from his source. And, of course, that's quite volatile and quite debatable, but that's one way to interpret it.
And so, John, when it comes to this idea of taking channeled information and applying some standard or yardstick by which to determine its reliability, how did you approach that dilemma when it comes to this project?
Well, I bring the same discernment or judgment or perspective to the suicide in particular channel sources that I did and still do to any other sources that don't involve suicide, just people who've naturally died or even sources that aren't supposedly human. What I would say in a nutshell is, across it all, it is an agnostic situation. the jury stays out with regard to being able to irrefutably prove one way or the other. I don't think the skeptic can say irrefutably, I can prove that that channel is not receiving the information from the source it claims to be getting it from, beyond him or herself. And conversely, I don't think the channel or the supporters of channels or New Age aficionados can irrefutably prove to the skeptic or to anybody else that the sources are who they claim to be. The only times you really can do that quite closely is if the information being received is so evidential that only the source that is no longer physically alive could know that information, and it can be really controlled for enough. Only then can you really say, this really is the smoking gun. Short of that, it's a judgment call whether or not you choose to believe that the source is really who it says it is, and it really is not just a channel and a dissociated unconscious state or wishful thinking or anything else. And so channeling sort of turns off a certain percentage of people on all levels, in all categories, because it's not a cut-and-dried scene. It's a mixed bag. I think some people who claim to be channeling probably really aren't. It's just coming from their own unconscious. And some people who think they aren't channeling, including some inventors and scientists, I think, who are making real breakthroughs with inspiration and intuition, may be receiving stuff from transcendental sources that is being fed to them unconsciously. So it's a big mixed bag.
So, Pamela, where are these spirits?
Well, they seem to be on different levels of what's considered the afterlife. And when you look at a lot of what mediums say, many of them talk about there being multiple planes or levels of existence beyond the physical plane, and that they may be, different people describe them different ways, varying densities, and they describe different numbers of them. 7, 9 are very common numbers, with supposedly the higher you go up, the closer to the source, whatever you want to call that source, the higher vibration it is. And suicides may often start at a level of vibration that's low, that's very close to the earth plane, but eventually, like everyone else, they appear to be able to progress. But can I just make one comment about why people should care whether this channeled material has any validity at all? It's that we try to cross-corroborate it. The same way that a cop would try to cross-corroborate eyewitnesses to something that happened, an event. And he would ask different ones, and they'd all give him their different stories, just like the channeled messages are different stories. You try to cross-corroborate. You look for common ground. You look for where everybody from every culture and every time says the same things. And then you see if you can add other streams of information or data to also supplement that, such as near-death experiences, which we do include in the book, reincarnation research, past life hypnotherapy regressions. You look for every different kind of method you could get at this information, and you see whether or not there's common ground, and they are all saying the same thing. And then you can put a little more credence into it. You can trust it a little more.
Now, we have to take our first break here. And, Pamela, your website is PamelaHeath.com. That's spelled H-E-A-T-H. John, what is your website?
www.john, without an H, JonKlimo.com.
Okay, simple enough. JonKlimo.com and PamelaHeath.com. They are the authors of Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. We'll find out more about those conversations when we return. I'm Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange. Broadcasting live from Asheville, North Carolina, land of the sky, it's the show where we discuss the unusual, the remarkable, the extraordinary, every Saturday night, 8 to 11 p.m. East Coast time. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and it's Speaking of Strange, and this is certainly a strange topic we're discussing right now with Pamela Heath and John Klimo, authors of Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. John, tell us some about these channeled conversations.
Well, they're drawn from, in a scholarly way, from hundreds of different sources from the past 120 years or so, and from contemporary seances, you could call them, that we set up particularly to try to reach these terror suicide bombers of recent years. They come from all walks of life. They're very often a book was written, like privately printed, from the family or from the surviving loved one, after having received information back from let's say a son or daughter who had killed him or herself, trying to rectify what had happened, or to just say, to try to finish the unfinished business, to get a little kind of a compensation, dispensation from the other side. Can I please come back and talk to my mother, so to speak? And either the mother becomes a one-shot channel, or she comes through somebody else. The deceased comes through somebody else, and the mother's gotten in touch with that kind of a story. So there's a wide variety of young and old, and men and women, and different cultures from which these suicides stem, having lived a life that way, and then having killed themselves one way or another, the kinds of messages that is conveyed from these people who took their own lives is quite varied, and we have a lot of different categories of them. I mean, there's descriptions of the afterlife experience itself, the adjustment problems they have, their messages of regret back to those still alive, messages particularly to those contemplating suicide who are still alive, messages to those left behind, those kinds of categories of messages. And again, like Pam pointed out, there's a tremendous consensus across all these hundreds of sources and 120 years of material we looked at, that so like a Greek chorus saying essentially the same thing over and over, including at the bottom line of it all, do not kill yourself. It's not worth it. You do not get out of anything. There's no quick fix to this. You'll just carry the baggage and the unfinished business that drove you to suicide into the other side and maybe back into reincarnation.
So across the board, they all say this was a mistake.
Virtually across the board, I can't say 100%. I mean, some say it's not a mistake because they were driven to suicide by extreme psychological and or physical pain to the point that, you know, no jury of their peers could really fault them for taking that out. I mean, from that frame of reference, you'd say, well, who could say you shouldn't have done that? And on the other side, they say, I have relief now. I had no other choice. Now, maybe they did have other choices. They never really prayed for help, thought that was possible, or whatever. So, I'll leave it there.
Well, Pamela, how do you feel about this concept of assisted suicide, like Dr. Kevorkian was convicted for?
Well, as a physician myself, and someone who's been asked to assist in suicide, I have to say that on a personal level, I'm not comfortable with it. But that said, we have a whole chapter on assisted suicide in this book. And one of the kind of surprises for me is that most of these people have no regrets. They had very smooth transitions. So they're quite different from the people who took the lives of a healthy body. When you take the life of an ill body, they still say it should be a very thoughtful decision. You should discuss it with everybody around you. You should make sure everybody's at peace with this. You should consider whether there might be a karmic reason why you needed to suffer or not. But if you make that decision, it doesn't really look like there's going to be a penalty for that, or that the person who assists you will be considered a murderer. So it was a little bit surprising to me.
And in light of that, what Pam just said, there's a lot of call, I think, on this side for people to want to believe that if you kill yourself, that you're going to be, according to a Judeo-Christian or traditional religion, you're going to fry in hell, as the saying goes. You know, you're going to be punished. There's a wrathful Old Testament God who's going to get you for that. That's a no-no. Or let alone if you kill others in the process, like a suicide bomber, you're really going to get it. You're going to get the punishment beyond imagination, and it's a judgmental, punitive situation. Well, we found over and over and over again, literally 100%, that there is no judgmental, wrathful God to throw you into Hades to burn forever and ever. That is part of a mythic system on our side, no matter what the organized religions say. It's a shared belief system that's been carried on by tradition and our culture. What really happens is you judge yourself. You're not judged as much as you judge yourself, and the judgment is as much self-reflection and it is necessary to learn and grow from the experience and not leave yourself unchanged from it, and hopefully to become more loving and more compassionate toward others and to not repeat such deeds I think that that's part of it also.
Well, now, how do suicide bombers describe the world they live in on the other side?
well, they were actually, I thought, sort of humorous to try to interview. All they'll say is it wasn't what we expected. But what the spirit guides that specialize in dealing with these souls say is that they will often keep them separate, sometimes in groups, but they'll certainly keep the bomb makers separate, you know, those who send the suicide bombers out, separate from the suicide bombers. And they will actually create sort of walls of energy to try and block off some of their emotion and stuff from the spirit realm, from sort of leaking in and contaminating or disturbing others in spirit.
Well, is there a physical description of this world in which they lived? They say, you know, it's dark here, or, you know, we're being tortured here. I mean, what do they say is actually happening to them on a daily basis, so to speak?
Well, you know, as the saying on this side goes, you create your own reality.
Mm-hmm.
When you get onto the other side, you essentially are continuing to create your own reality, but in a much more obvious and short-time turnaround way. The thinking makes it so. Thoughts are things. The inner that normally we consider your subjective or inner or imaginative or remembered experiences here on Earth in a body, over there become your external environment, things coming back at you. The inside literally is the external surrounding environment now. And you sort of, as the saying goes, you prepare a place for yourself under which you go by your quality of your life in this just finished incarnation. And so those who, again, the karmic fruits of their thinking and their doing on this level of reality that they carry over with them are grown in a climate that is very much like a dream or a half lucid dream or a fog. Some people don't even know they're dead. A lot of people don't even know that they've died.
They don't get their virgins either.
Oh, no, they don't get their virgins. But some of them, you know, many of them, not so much the suicides, but they go to a place that they think they should be going to. In other words, their expectations are fulfilled, at least short term. It's kind of a wish fulfillment situation. So good Christians go to kind of a good Christian heaven, at least for a while, until a larger, more subsuming reality kind of takes over after they've kind of got acclimatized and been worked with by guides and teachers on that side. Similarly, if you didn't expect anything, like my father was an atheist and he died and thought there would be a void and nothingness, and a couple of days after he died, I didn't expect it, but he came back and was very bewildered, as often people who don't expect anything after they die are bewildered, and they don't know whether they're sleeping or awake, whether it's a dream or not, or a bad dream. Well, suicide bombers enter a bad dream. It's really their co-authored bad dream. And they have to be haunted, so to speak, coming back at them as if it's from the external environment, haunted by the repercussions of their acts and the dark movie they are co-authoring that tells them about the shoulds and the should-nots of spirit, either on this side of reality or the other. You just can't get away with these things, so to speak. You plant the seeds by all your acts, and then, like in the afterlife, you harvest them, but you also harvest them like in a learning machine, in a schooling situation. It's part of soul growth, as these spirits, both suicides and others, tell us over and over.
Well, now, since these spirits are essentially non-physical to us here in this realm, in their realm, do they have a physical environment, physical bodies that age and all these things? Is it simply like a bizarro version of what we live in here, so to speak?
Well, they age if they feel them aged. In this sense, they're no different from the ghosts that you run into, in that if they feel young, they'll look young. If they feel old, they'll look old. They are, to some extent, creating their own realities and creating what's around them within limits, because what the spirit guides are trying to do is gradually ease them into the truth of things. And they will also have them sort of replay little movie moments of their lives, look at it, and then experience it from the shoes, so to speak, of the people who were around them, people they helped and people they harmed.
Okay, now let's go ahead and take another break, because this is so fascinating. I want to make sure we don't have to rush through any answers here. And I am talking right now with Pamela Heath and John Klimo. They are authors of this new book, Suicide, what really happens in the afterlife, channeled conversations with the dead. And I want to ask them a little bit more about channeling in general, in terms of whether or not anyone can be channeled. Do you have to wait for them to come to you, or can you go out there and find somebody in particular? There are all kinds of questions that can be asked here. And if any of you would like to get in here and ask a question, our numbers are locally 240-9962 or toll-free nationwide 800-570-9962. You can learn more about Pamela Heath at PamelaHeath.com. Her last name is spelled H-E-A-T-H. And you can learn more about John Klimo at JohnKlimo.com. His name is spelled J-O-N-K-L-I-M-O. I am Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange on News Radio 570 WWNC, the talk of the mountains.
Five! Numbers! Numbers are cool! Go ahead, start
with me. I saw a werewolf from the Chinese menu. Walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for a place called Eat Whole Foot Shack. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein. Ah-ho, werewolves in London. Ah-ho. Ah-ho, werewolves in London. Ah-ho. You hear him howling around your kitchen.
Oh, man.
You better not let him in.
I've been talking on the radio for a while now, but I never thought you'd hear me singing on the radio.
Again, very scary, sir.
Does that just boost my entire credibility? Am I going to get more money and everything now because I can sing on the radio as well as talk on the radio?
It's just talent in the closet.
That was us at our Lemur Benefit Concert. We're going to play some tracks throughout the show just like that to give you a little taste of what you may have missed, or at least if you were there, well, you get to relive it all over again. I am Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange, and not only is it strange for us to be singing Werewolves of London to raise funds for paranormal research, but it's also strange when you think about the implications leading to what happens when we all die, and in particular, if we take our own lives. Is it sort of like cheating at this game we call life? Well, that's one of the questions we are exploring here with Pamela Heath and John Klimo, co-authors of Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife. And, you know, John, you mentioned earlier that some of these spirits have, you know, adjustment problems. Can you give us some examples of those adjustment problems?
Well, it's often a function of expectations. If you were taught by your religion or your parents or whatever, or you came upon it on your own during your life, that X is going to happen after you die, that you will be met this way, that this is going to be the other side, and you get to the other side and it isn't that way, then that's a violation of expectations. It's also, it can be a bit bewildering, and If you're not initially met by a spirit guide or helper or a fellow discarnate human spirit who's been over there long enough to have learned the job of helping newcomers, you know, faltering their way across, then it can really be very, very disconcerting. You could sort of, you know, have a almost panic, and like my father was so lost, just a lost soul for a while. So that's one thing. Another is that you may not, like in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, the Bardo is considered the other side, the afterlife, and you can be trained in this life to be prepared to die, so that you don't lose consciousness as you go toward the other side, as you go through death and into the afterlife. And if you don't lose consciousness, then you can keep that thread going, that self-awareness thread, and not fall mercy to the temptations, the Maya, the hallucinations, the projections, the creating your own reality, stuff coming out of your own unconscious that really makes the heavens and hells flashing by you. It can be very, it's like one of those, you know, the tunnel of scariness in an amusement park or something.
Right. Well, Pamela, how do you feel about this idea of demons and angels and these kinds of beings in the afterlife?
Well, I guess I don't like those terms. To me, they're very loaded in a way, and you don't know what somebody means when they talk about, oh, I ran into a demon or an angel. I guess I tend to talk about spirits, and some of them are positive, some of them are negative. Certainly one of the adjustment problems spirits can have is if they were drug addicts or alcoholics and drunk at the time they passed over, that adds to the confusion. And they can still carry that addiction with them into the afterlife, because even though they don't have a body, they're still psychologically addicted. And there are certainly stories of them trying to get other alcoholics or drug addicts to be more, to use the drugs more or to drink more, so they can get high vicariously.
No bars on the other side then, huh?
Only the ones you self-create.
That'd be a big bar.
And also, there are a few other adjustment problems that one is, can be faced with, like, you know, maybe only then that you really stop and think after the self-absorption of the psychological and or physical pain that had led up to pushing you over the edge. You lost the wisdom or the count to 10, you know, and really reflect opportunity. But then you get over there on the other side due to the rashness of the death, self-caused death. And then and only then are you faced with the repercussions of your self-homicide to other people. In other words, the harm caused to those still living. And part of the life review that usually occurs, it's reported that usually occurs after one dies, not just suicides, but all beings, but particularly with suicides, it's often in that life review that you see, oh, my God, you know, these are the sins of omission and the sins of commission, especially the sins of commission, of having committed suicide, that I'm now looking at, like in a kind of a videoic, episodic hologram kind of a thing, very very rapidly, and it cuts right to the quick, and that makes for problems to just sort of take on that burden of the responsibility, which you might not have wanted to think about before you killed yourself and right up until you killed yourself.
So now, John, if you wanted to go out and have a particular deceased person channeled, how accurate do you feel a channeler would be who could come in and say, I'm going to, well, for example, I had a lady on one time who said she could channel President John F. Kennedy. And now whether or not she did, you know, there are lots of different opinions. But how specific can the request be?
Well, for over 100 years, ever since the beginning of the spiritualist church in the latter part of the 19th century, there has been a practice of mediums, sometimes also serving as ministers in the spiritualist church as well, wearing both hats, being someone who you go to try to get in touch with a particular being or entity on the other side, usually a loved one or a family member, whatever. And so you go to this person who's the go-between to do that. And this is being carried over clear to today. People like John Edward and James Van Praagh and George Anderson and many others who've written best-selling books about this, who, again, are the people that other people go to mediate communication, usually for a chosen spirit that the person going to the medium wants to get in touch with. And then there's those that you go to a medium or a channel because their entity, who isn't somebody you know, their entity is on the other side or is discarnate or transphysical and is able to get the information that wouldn't be able to be gotten by you alive. But when you do supposedly get in touch with that discarnate human spirit that you went to somebody on that to establish that hotline to speak with or hear from, how do you then know whether you've got who you maybe paid money for to hear, you know? And then it comes down to what's called evidential information. Does the source say things to you or to anybody else who then be privy to talking to you for verification, say things that could only be coming from that source rather than like a lucky what people call a cold call, where you kind of study body language and inflections from the person you're working with, but you're really kind of fraudulent, and you're fishing for things. And a lot of times on television, you see that it's not really a bullseye as much as it's in the ballpark, sort of. But anybody maybe could have guessed that or read the body language and played that dance with the person who would come to you to get in touch with that spirit. So, but in general, you know, your listeners also need to know that there's a whole no-no to this in the organized religions, that this is bad, this is consorting with demons and spirits that go peep in the night, and you'll fry in hell if you go to see a medium, and it's all bad stuff, and there's nothing good about it. And that is just throwing the baby out with the bathwater 100 times over, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Pam.
I'm just going to say, I know Chris Fleming, who's on Dead Famous on the Biography Channel Tuesday night, and part of the format for their show is to find specific celebrities and see if they can make contact. And it's sort of interesting because from the medium's viewpoint, sometimes you can get a sense of whether this spirit is lying to you and trying to pretend to be someone they aren't. Sometimes you get a sense that, yeah, they're who they say they are. But a lot of times you can't make contact, or you don't make it when you expect to make it. Like, he might have been waiting for them to set up the cameras, and all of a sudden a spirit comes through, and then it's gone. And, you know, too late, not going to get it on the cameras. Or nobody will come through at all. And, you know, it's a mixed bag, even from the viewpoint of the person doing the channeling. You'll often be aware it's a mixed bag.
You know, this topic, it really helps us to explore this strange connection between the mind and body. And I know you are also an expert on telekinesis, Pamela. Do you see any connections there, and what this relationship between ourselves and our environment and our mind is all about?
Yeah, actually, psychokinesis, which is mind over matter stuff, is something I think we're all capable of, just as we're all capable of ESP. It's just a matter of whether the situation is such that you need to be able to do it, you know, such as poltergeist phenomena, where people need a stress reliever and objects start flying. I think it's part of us creating our own reality on a physical plane, just like in the afterlife, we literally create our own realities, too, within certain limits.
How realistic is it that one day I will be able to use the Force like Darth Vader and make objects move around? Because I have dreams like that all the time. Is that realistic at all?
Yeah, if you're under enough stress, it is.
Oh, great. Well, I might be able to do that in that case. Yeah, funny. I'm always dreaming that I can. Maybe it's just my laziness that makes me feel that way. But have you ever moved an object without physically touching it, Pamela?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I've done PK, and that's part of why I actually went back to school and got a doctorate degree in parapsychology and also wrote the book The PK Zone, because I was trying to understand why I could do things science told me were impossible.
By the way, there was one good demonstrator of psychokinesis who was able to do it pretty much on demand. I forget his name right now.
Martin Caden. Martin Caden could turn energy wheels from across the room in a vacuum chainer.
Well, the guy I'm thinking of, I don't think it was Caden, was the way he would do it, speaking of that earlier kind of asphyxiation weird illusion, he would hold his breath until just before he passed out. Of course, there's no damage done because you'll start breathing again normally as soon as you go unconscious. But just before, when he's just about to feel he's suffocating, he's about to die, you know, all voluntary, at that point, he would then, boing, go for the PK, you know, to move the thing, to whatever it was. And but he could only really be successful when he thought he was about to die. That's that kind of emergency
And that's a belief on his part that's not necessarily
No,
true.
It's not necessarily so, but that was the kind of the bizarre way he made connections to the paranormal, that I only can do it under such extreme circumstances. And yogas and Siddha practitioners and other cultures and so on are able to in normal contexts achieve these human potentials, and I do truly believe we're all capable of them.
Well, we got to take another break, and when we come back, I want to ask you, Pamela, for a tip on how we can all produce psychokinetic effects. I have to ask you that because I'm so intrigued by it, and I want to get your final thoughts about this new book as well. Pamela Heath and John Klimo are authors of this new book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. Her website is PamelaHeath.com. John's is JohnKlimo.com. And we'll resume our conversation here on Speaking of Strange right after this. We hope you're not heading there, folks. Don't create it for yourself. Don't kill yourself. There are no virgins waiting over there. We've learned that tonight from Pamela Heath and John Klimo, authors of Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, here on Speaking of Strange. I'm Joshua P. Warren. So, Pamela, give me some simple tips on what I can do to increase my psychokinetic ability.
Okay. When you're a beginner, first of all, you have to be open to the experience. Because a lot of people on some level are afraid of it. You want to do it when you feel energized or upbeat, not when you're exhausted or tired. You want to narrow your focus of attention to something. It can be a thought. It can be the target you're trying to affect. Doesn't matter what, but you really need to concentrate, focus. And you also need to allow yourself to be connected to something outside of yourself. And it can be about sort of imagining yourself as one with whatever you're trying to affect. You can't be serious. You need to shut up the thinking, rational mind that wants to analyze everything. That blocks a lot of people, by the way. But you can either do it in a playful state. You can do it if you're feeling really emotional. Any kind of strong emotion, I blow light bulbs when I'm angry, for example. Any kind of emotion makes it easier for beginners to do.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that you will hear people getting into it is in sort of a detached state of consciousness, which is why other people, when they're meditating, will talk about having experiences. So there's a variety of sort of doorways to be able to do it. But you kind of need to let go of the sense of individual identity. And those are probably the biggies right there. I do have a chapter in the PK Zone that talks about tips for beginners and how, once you can do it, to get better at it based on what we learn from the experience of people who do it.
I'm going to buy that book. Thank you very much for those wonderful tips. And we only have a few minutes left, but I do want to try to squeeze in a phone call. Hello there, Janet. Welcome to Speaking of Strange.
Hi. I have a question. I am a nurse, and I sometimes work with people who have attempted to kill themselves and failed.
Uh-huh.
What do you say to these people? I feel like just telling them, don't do this, you're just going to make things worse.
All right. I think we accidentally lost John. We're getting him back.
No, I'm not here.
Okay, we must have lost Pamela then. Okay, John, you want to take that one?
Well, it wasn't like a near-death experience, was it? Did they have any experience of what happened after they tried to kill themselves that was kind of otherworldly or afterlife-like?
No.
They just came back. They just came back here, and they realized they had tried to kill themselves and failed, right?
Right.
And what you say to them is, well, what you would say to anybody who's even only thinking of it and hasn't even tried it yet, this whole suicide prevention complex literature is that your life is not yours to take, in the sense that you didn't give yourself this life. It was given to you, whether you believe in a God or nature with a capital N, or just a multidimensional complex universe we don't begin to understand yet. Somewhere in the cards, you were given this life. And how should we be playing it out? Should we be playing like unto gods and take it away prematurely? And should we deny ourselves the experience of staying alive? Because there must have been some reason to have been here to be learning and growing, no matter how painful it might have been. It's always easy to say that when physical pain is involved. Hello?
Something phantasmal has happened here. I don't know what that was. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John. My goodness. Maybe some spirits are not happy with what's happening here at the end of our conversation. Do we have Pamela with us? John?
Sounds like—
wow.
Very seriously, this sounds like a possible sabotage or intrusion. I'm being serious.
Well, that was— something weird's going on. You know, I just talk into the microphone, so I don't know what's happening here with all the buttons and switches and blinky things around me, but
I was on the Dreamland show with Whitley Strieber a few years ago, and I'd just gotten off the air, and a voice said to him, not to him, but everybody in the audience heard it, can you hear me? And they checked for it all, and the sound engineer came and said that there's no way that could have intruded and gone out on the airwaves. It was totally a controlled environment, and it was, like, real eerie, and it freaked Strieber out.
Man, something strange has just happened, and we only have, like, 45 seconds left, but I apologize for that. We'll try to get to the bottom of it, but I do want to thank both of you very much for being on the program this evening, and I advise everyone to go to PamelaHeath.com. Last name is H-E-A-T-H.com, and JohnKlimo.com. Last name is K-L-I-M-O, and remember, that's John without an H. The book is Suicide. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and who knows? Maybe we had an intrusion of some sort. Sometimes it just hits the fan, and you got to roll with it on live radio. Folks, that's going to do it for this hour. When we come back, we're going to have Professor Solomon how to make the most of a flying saucer experience.